This is Angela Ewing with Storytime, Episode 5 of 9 O'Clock Horses. My brother was away doing his 2-year stint in the army. After the war between 1945 and 63, 2.5 million young men from all over Britain were compelled to do their time in national service. Military bases had to be manned in Germany, Austria, Palestine and Aden. The Suez Canal zone had to be held down as well as Cyprus, Singapore, Hong Kong and a chain of lesser military bases. Douglas didn't want to go, but it was clear by in the immediate post-war political landscape that Britain had considerable obligations and only a limited number of men still in service. The house seemed quiet now without Douglas and Pauline. I relied on my friends at school for company, although I disliked the school from the very beginning because it was a secondary modern school. I should have been attending a high school as my sister had done. But as destiny would have it, I had scarlet fever when I was 11 and home from school for 2 months. I missed the important 11-plus examination. I was isolated in the small back bedroom at home, feeling desperate that if I couldn't take the examination, where would I end up? This special exam would dictate which future school I would be allowed to attend. If I passed, I could go to a high school. If I didn't, I'd be destined to attend a secondary modern school for students with lower IQs. To think that an illness would eliminate me from taking the examination was very upsetting. Dr. Mann, who now was only one of a few doctors to make house calls, visited me and told my mother I should be further along in my recovery. They had no idea it was just worry that prevented me from getting better. But mother was annoyed. She blamed the lack of attention from the doctor on the national health system. "It's this damn socialist government," she said. "I'd sooner pay for the doctor for better care privately than have all the tax associated with this national health service and get no service." The NHS in UK began in 1948. Consequently, Britain has lost a lot of doctors who went to America or Australia to open up their own practices to escape the many rules and regulations the national health system required. This exodus of doctors was known as the brain drain from England. Memories of my secondary modern school years are sketchy, but I do remember our school uniforms, navy blue tunic, white blouses, ties with black and white stripes. Very smart, I thought, but not the thick black woolen stockings we had to wear. After school, if I had arranged to meet my friends, I would slip into the school bathrooms and change into nylon stockings, purchased at great expense from Marks and Spencer's. I made sure the seams at the back were straight. It was a nuisance to have to change back into woolen stockings before I went home, but I knew my mother would have a fit if she saw me in sheer stockings. "Nice girls don't wear see-through stockings to show off their legs," she said. Despite my supposedly poor education, I was good at acting. I loved the drama class. I could be anyone I wanted to be on stage. I never played Amelia Norton. I liked character acting, and before I left school, at the age of 16, I won a scholarship to the Beaver Drama Academy and took advantage of the elocution lessons that were offered. Leicester dialect was not charming. I had acquired it not from my parents, but my contemporaries at school. It was the end of term school play, open to parents and the general public. I was playing the lead part as a princess. The back of the hall was full of adults as usual. Toddlers and very young children were seated at the front. As I stood at the edge of the stage ready to speak my well-rehearsed lines, I could see the children looking up at me expectantly in my shimmering pink princess dress. Toward the end of the play, I gazed over the edge of the stage. "Fish, fish, you that know me," I quoted, standing on tiptoe. "Dimly shimmering fins below me, thirsty throats that no draught can slake. Go and drain my father's lake." All the children rose from their seats to look for the fish. In the audience was the director of the Kirby Players, a local drama group who performed plays every month. Stephen Connery was a blustery large man with a ruddy complexion. After the play, he asked me if I would join his group. What a thrill for me! So began my amateur acting career, and it was a surprise and a delight when I was accepted at Leicester's new BBC Two, Radio Leicester, to take part in their radio dramas. It seemed that the pastor of the local Baptist church had been listening to one of the radio plays in which I had been cast. The pastor was a young, pale-faced man with sandy hair. He asked me if I would be in their production for the church and cast me as Ruth in the biblical play that ran for 3 weekends. Because of this man, I became fascinated with the Bible and read it from cover to cover. I went to the church just to be near him. He said he would very much like me to be a Sunday school teacher when I was older. I must have had a real crush on him, but that changed when one evening I was sitting in the front pew looking up adoringly at this sandy-haired man who I admired so much. He looked directly at me and pointed his finger in my direction. His eyes seemed to search my soul as he announced dramatically, "You are a sinner." I wasn't to know he intended those 4 words to apply to all his congregation, but I took it to heart. I wept bitterly as I told my mother what she'd said. She was so angry, she swiped the tea towel she was holding against the counter, sending one of our best china cups and saucer flying to the floor. As she swept up the broken pieces, she said, "You're a child, no more a sinner than the man in the moon." She rose from the floor, and with the brush pointing in my direction, she said, "You shan't go back to that church. Is that clear? I won't have your mind filled with such godswallop." I never did go back, but I never quite got over the fact that somehow I had sinned against this God who the sandy-haired pastor had talked about so often. Unfortunately, that event made me uncomfortable in any church. To please my father, who wanted me to be baptized, since I had not been when I was an infant, I attended the pre-baptismal lessons offered at St. Michael's Church of England downtown. The minister sat with me for several sessions with questions that I could not answer. He explained the Bible and talked about Jesus, proverbs that originally had intrigued me, but now I did not believe. At last he shook his head and said sadly, "I don't think you'll ever be on our roundabout. Perhaps you should get off." I could only surmise that what he was trying to say was that I did not have his faith, and it was better to let me go. He was wasting his time trying to convince me that the path of righteousness as a Christian was the only way to get to heaven. Later, I attended an evening class at Vaughan College in Leicester. I had the privilege of being a student with Sir Mortimer Wheeler, the archaeologist, for one term. He was talking about the Roman remains of Leicester's Jewry Wall and the wonderful Roman mosaic floors discovered underneath shops along the High Street. The Romans had brought their armies, built roads, one of which still exists. It was the Romans who taught the art of government, business, and introduced the public house and beer, with the hops grown in Kent. Leicester was a Roman town and the seat of government long before London. But aside from the history of England's past, I liked the theory of evolution, Darwinism. At least, I could identify with it, and it made sense to me. In the meantime, Colin, tired of weekend trips back and forth to London on the train, purchased a motorbike. He bought me a smart waterproof suit and a helmet. We toured the countryside around Leicester and visited castles and beauty spots, places we could never have gone to without our own means of transport. After a few months, his visits back to Foxby, even with the new motorbike, became less and less. He said there was so much going on in London. I did visit his little boarding house once or twice, but it soon became obvious he liked to hang around with his new friends. I don't know if it was because my father knew I was disappointed that I didn't see Colin as often as before, But suddenly a new car, appeared on the scene, a Rover he had purchased from one of his mates at work. Instead of Colin taking me to beautiful places, my father did. At that time, I had no idea that my mother was growing more and more jealous of me. She laughed when I told her we were going to the ballet in Nottingham. "Fancy a man liking ballet," she said. He and I always went to the movie theatre on Monday evenings. It was a 2-mile walk to the theatre, but in the summer evenings when it was still not quite dark, it stays light until 10 p.m. in summer in England, we passed the gardens of our neighbours who lined their garden beds with night-scented stock. The sweet smell clung to the warm air as we walked home in the growing dusk. I began to realize that if I had not had the experience of living with my Aunt Dorothy and Uncle Walter, I would have accepted my parents' indifference towards each other as perfectly normal. I found myself studying my parents when they were at home together. There was no amicable chatter between the two of them, no casual comments. My father was usually reading a book, and my mother sat in her armchair, knitting pullovers for Douglas. If they ever shared a tender moment, I was never privy to it. My mother didn't seem the slightest bit interested in going to see ruins of castles. "It's just a lot of old stones," she'd said to me. I remember saying, "Well, what about the history of the place from 400 and hundreds of years ago? Don't you think that's interesting?" "Not really." One of my favourite places to visit was Bradgate Park. There the ruins of the home of Lady Jane Grey still hold magic for me. To know that the 16-year-old Jane was Queen of England for 9 days before Henry VIII decided to have her beheaded. The estate of the Grey family has been preserved as a park since then. Legend has it that all the trees on the estate were beheaded when Jane was. My mother criticised my father when he sat for many evenings working on tapestries as seat covers, one each as a gift for his brothers and sisters. "Not a masculine pastime for a man, is it?" she'd said. So the allotment was the most enjoyable place for me in summer because I was with my father. As a former farm worker, he valued the large space of ground to grow vegetables and flowers. I decided this was where he was happy. The fact that he provided most of our neighbours with fresh vegetables was not the main reason for his work on summer evenings and every weekend, summer or winter. Everyone who lived in council houses owned by Leicester City had the opportunity to rent an allotted garden space. There were acres and acres of land designated for extra gardening space during and after the war. My father's garden was immaculate. Rose bushes grew each side of the long grassy path that led to a little shed where all the tools were kept, plus a journal for making careful notes of what had been planted and on what date. I loved it there in that little hut. I made it into my home away from home with curtains at the windows. I bought pretty teacups and a teapot from Leicester Market. My father built a fire pit at the bottom of the garden, and we had what I called smoky tea, sitting on a log under the gnarled branches of a very old apple tree. I learned about vegetable gardening, the correct way to dig troughs for potatoes and onion sets. I helped harvest all the produce, rhubarb and gooseberries, cabbages, kale, Brussels sprouts, scarlet runner beans, and produce from the greenhouse, mainly tomatoes and cucumbers. During the summers, I never wanted to miss time with my father in the garden. Sitting under the apple tree one day, he told me about his childhood in the country, the time he was a farmer at Farnival's farm, leading a plough behind a horse, milking the cow named Daisy. Sipping our smoky tea, I asked him how he'd met my mother. "She was a beautiful woman," he said, smiling. "Yes, lovely dark hair, incredible blue eyes. Unusual, really." "And what else?" I asked. "I thought she understood me." By the way he looked into space as he was talking, I suspected there was more to his story, so I asked him, "You don't think she does? Understand you, I mean?" "Well, Vicky is complicated, you know. She was brought up differently from me." Her mother scraped a living taking in washing. I left Furnival's at the farm because I wanted to study architecture. There was always a pretty good university in Leicester, and there still is. And I knew with my grammar school education I could be enrolled. Of course, the course cost money, and rather than rely on my parents, I found a menial job, believe it or not, collecting rents. You mean going door to door? He nodded. You see, I was in a boarding house close to the university, just one room, you know, but it was convenient to go out in the evenings at night for a few hours. Grey Street, where Vicky lived, was on my route. She seemed to want to go out with me on occasion, and we went for walks and just met now and then. Things just went from there. Well, it doesn't sound very romantic, I said. Ah, yes, well, I had my romance with Violet. Violet? I've not heard about her. No, that was in the past. Oh, yes, Violet, she had red hair. You had an affair with her? He nodded. She was Mr. Furnival's daughter. As he told me, I began to imagine the scene. Edward was one of the oldest of five children. His mother, Louise, and his father, Frank, had 11 children. Sadly, diphtheria and tuberculosis took its toll, leaving 3 boys and 2 girls, Edward, Bill, John, Ida, and Dorothy. When Louise and Frank had left Kilby Manor, where they worked for 16 years as maid and butler, Frank was hired by Furnival's farm and was given a house to live in the lane alongside the fields. As long as a member of the family worked at the farm, the house would remain for them to live in. Edward was 16 when he left grammar school, with great expectations. But his parents suggested that if they were to live in the house, it was essential that one of the boys learn to be a farmer. Their father was getting older and had to reduce the long hours of working with the horses and the plough. Edward had to step into his shoes. Before long, Edward had become friends with Violet, Mr. Furnival's daughter, same age. At first, they would just take long walks along the perimeter of the big field, where the bright yellow celandines grew in abundance, under the hawthorn hedges, talking about what they were going to do, what they were going to be when they were older. Violet was planning to go to university in Cambridge to study horticulture. Edward told her after his brother Bill was old enough to take his place at the farm, he was off to university. They both had dreams that would lead them to a wealthy life if they had the necessary degrees. World War I was just about to end, and the future looked bright for both of them. Every day, Violet would encourage Edward to join her in the big barn near the outhouses. She was a girl who wanted to experience everything. Edward was very willing and was entranced with this beautiful girl who was also willing to give herself to him without reservation. Edward thought she was heaven sent and was prepared to ask her father for her hand in marriage. He told Violet many times he loved her and that he wanted to marry her. At first, Violet would laugh at him. Edward, we're just having fun, aren't we? Yes, Edward would say, but and we can have this sort of fun wherever if we are together. After a very torrid love session in the barn one late afternoon, Edward proposed. He begged her to be his wife. Violet sighed. Edward, why would I want to marry you? My father would not allow it anyway. I mean, let's face it, she said, smiling brightly. He owns all the cottages in the lane and half the land in the village. Why would he allow me to marry a nobody like you? Your parents were in service at the manor, can't you see? We're miles apart in every sense of the word. Edward could hardly breathe. He was so surprised. Don't you love me? He finally managed. Don't be silly. Love has nothing to do with it. We have fun, don't we? Let's not spoil it. But it did spoil it for Edward. The love affair was over, leaving him with a broken heart. When I realized there was suddenly silence as the images of a young man and a girl faded away in my mind, I could feel all my father's emotion for once out in the open. So I said, "Did you ever see her again?" "You mean Violet?" He shook his head. "No, I left the farm. My parents never knew the reason, and my dad had to stay until he was far too old to be hauling a plough behind a tractor and milking cows the every day. He developed asthma, which eventually did him in. I didn't care if I never saw the farm again. That's when I went to live in Leicester and met your mother." "Did you ever find out what happened to Violet?" I asked. "Well, I heard that she did go to Cambridge, but she was killed later in the Blitz." "What a sad story," I said. "How were your parents able to keep the house when your dad couldn't be there anymore on the farm?" My father thought for a minute. "Well, I'd like to think that Violet persuaded her father to let our family stay. A new agreement was drawn up that as long as one of our family stayed in the house, it would be rent-free as it is today." I finished the conversation by saying that Mum got the short end of the stick then, really. My father said yes. I suppose she did.
You have been listening to episode 5 of 9 O'Clock Horses. Please tune in next week for episode 6, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this program and want to hear more like it, consider supporting Curry Coast Community Radio and help us get on the air. For more information, go to our website, kciw.org. Thank you for listening.